Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Today is November the 7th, 2018, the year of the Lord. Let's not forget that that is the referent there. It's not 2018 of something else. It's 2018, the year of the Lord. Maybe at the end of the year, we'll actually like consider how this actually was the year of the Lord. And then as we make our transition to 2019, how we might actually make it more the year of the Lord next year than we experienced it this year. So even just in our own experience, like, how could I just take that phrase and really lay claim to it in unique ways? So I was just a mental note there making for myself. Okay, you know by now that the House flipped in terms of Congress, in terms of the United States Congress. You know that there will be a majority of congressmen representing the Democrat Party. There has been a majority representing the GOP or the Republican Party. The Republican Party did not only retain a majority in the Senate, its majority actually grew. So we are going to find ourselves in what is known affectionately as divided government. Divided government is not a bad thing, by the way. Divided government provides checks and balances. Divided government is designed as a way for us to be accountable and hear ideas that we might not otherwise hear. It creates great stability in markets. Actually, financial markets love divided government. Why? Because divided government tends to do less. You can't have one group of people just running away with their ideas and trampling over others because, well, there's a firewall against that happening, and that is the body, whichever body it is, that is constituted by a majority of folks from the other party. So whether or not you woke up today and you found yourself in the majority, or whether or not you woke up today and found yourself in the minority, well, the reality is then you woke up in America, because we now have, of the three branches of government, one which will be controlled by the Democrats, and two which will continue to be controlled by the GOP. So we're talking here about the executive branch and the legislative branch. And then, you know, I probably didn't say that quite right, because obviously we don't think of the judiciary as being controlled by one branch of government. But I think it's fair to say we all now recognize that there are a majority of justices on the Supreme Court who have been nominated and confirmed by GOP presidents and GOP majority controlled senates. So there you go. All right. So I think that looking forward, you know, the sort of so what of what happened last night, and actually continues to happen, because some of these races are not yet quite decided, as you just heard in the news at the top of the hour. So what? Why does it matter to me? Because leadership sets the agenda. And I think you need to keep that in mind as we go forward. And you say, well, what do you mean by leadership? OK, so there are folks who serve in leadership in both the Senate and in the House. And the House leadership is now going to be Democrat, not Republican. And so when we talk about the folks, like the Speaker of the House has been Republican Paul Ryan. Well, the Speaker of the House will now be a Democrat, Nancy Pelosi, if she has her way. It'll be interesting to see how that works itself out. And leadership sets the agenda. And you will recall that it is the House that actually sets the budget. And so anything that the president wants done that's actually going to cost money is going to have to find its way through a Democrat-controlled House of Representatives. And any negotiations or compromises that are made, pieces of compromise legislation, that he is able to negotiate with a Democrat-controlled House of Representatives, he's going to have to then find a way to get those pieces of legislation through a increasingly GOP-controlled Senate. So it's going to be challenging. It ought to be fun. And I think we should approach it that way. Not only are we going to have leadership issues when we talk about the House itself, but every committee of the House will now have its leadership flipped. So for the last couple of years, every single committee of the House has been led by, like controlled by, Republicans. Now, every single one of those leadership chairs, literally like the chairman of every single committee, will now be a Democrat. And so you say, well, why does that matter? Well, because the leadership gets to choose the agenda. They get to set the agenda. They determine what pieces of legislation actually make their way through committee and to the floor. And so it does matter who sits in those seats of leadership throughout all of those levels. We've talked a little bit about divided government. That, you know, produces what some might just describe as stability. Others would describe it as gridlock. Financial markets are going to like it a lot, but it's going to frustrate those who actually want to see elected politicians do something, who actually want to see legislation move. I don't expect much legislation at all to move in the lame duck between now and when the next Congress is seated in January. So don't expect much legislation. But because the GOP grew its majority in the Senate, the president's appointments, those appointments that he gets to make, particularly to the judiciary at all levels, I think will not only continue, they may actually now accelerate. That process may actually be loosened up a little bit, and you may actually see some of those appointments accelerate, which would help because, you know, obviously we need people in all of those vacant posts. Okay, so I want to now speak to the gentleman who I'm going to refer to as the guy in the red vest. So the guy in the red vest sat at the end of a table that I was sitting at this past weekend, and he's concerned about Thanksgiving dinner. And so I thought, because, you know, on days like this, I could either talk the whole time about politics or I could talk about stuff that we all find, frankly, more important at the personal level, which is Thanksgiving is coming and people are coming to my house for Thanksgiving and they don't all agree with me. And not everybody is happy about what happened last night. Some people expected a blue wave and it was more of a ripple and they're going to be upset. And others woke up to find out that, wow, my congressional district that's always been rock solid red, I found out I woke up and it's blue. Or half the people in my state don't agree with me. Or that governor that I really liked, he didn't get elected last night. Hello, Wisconsin. So let's talk about Thanksgiving a little bit. So the guy in the red vest at the end of the table that I was sitting at on Sunday, he's very worried about Thanksgiving dinner. They're hosting it. You know, he's the guy in the family. He and his wife, you know, they have a nice house. Everybody comes to their house for Thanksgiving. But he's anticipating that there's going to be this, you know, freshman niece home from college for the first time. He describes her as now full of ideas. So we're going to talk about how to talk with that just newly home from college for the first time person. You remember being that person if you went to college. You suddenly knew more than everyone else who had ever lived. And so what is it like to have the new expert at the table, the expert about everything? We're going to talk about that. And then he's also concerned about a sister who is what I will describe as advocacy-minded, right? She has a genuinely merciful heart, so she's got a heart for every down and out group that you can imagine. And that's not a bad thing, right? But when you ask her to speak to her concerns with facts, or you try to make suggestions about processes, laws that would be required to be changed in order for her ideas to be accommodated, she starts crying. She leaves the table, right? That's not so great for Thanksgiving. You seem like the meanie, all right? And so he says, I can't win. I am the old white guy with a nice house. I can't win. So here's what I want to say. If you already know that you're hosting the Thanksgiving meal and you already know that your table is going to be filled with folks who disagree with you on pretty much everything, or at least a number of things, and you anticipate that those things are likely to come up because, frankly, that's what people like to do. And so what I suggested was, so actually... And those of you that have like been to Vacation Bible School training, which I don't think this guy had ever been, like he's never been a VBS volunteer, so he doesn't know these tricks. So I said, oh, are you familiar with the whole, you know, the concept of like table talk cards? Do you remember when we used to put those tent cards on the table and it was like the three things that you were supposed to talk about around the table? And it was designed to get people interacting and conversation starters. And he's like, no, I'm not familiar with that. I'm like, okay, well, so here's the idea. And I kind of laid it out for him. So there's no reason that you can't do that. At Thanksgiving. So you're going to make place cards for people, right? If you weren't, you should, because you sort of want to be sure that the right people are sitting, not necessarily next to each other, but not across from each other. Like, you don't want the people who you already know are adversarial, you don't want them across the table from each other. You'd actually like them sitting on the same side of the table, next to each other, where, you know, the person they agree with is sitting across the table from them. That's actually sort of the best way to go with these things. So think about the table dynamics. And then on those little place cards, you could actually, on the inside of each card, you could write a question. Things that you might find it fun to know about one another. Maybe there's somebody that could tell old stories of, you know, way back when, and they're never going to be asked that. But if you provoke it with a tabletop question, then they have the opportunity to do that. What's your favorite, I don't know. I mean, like, right? Come up with stuff. Come up with things that you would find interesting to learn about the people around your table, and make sure those things are not political. Like, be intentional about not writing down questions that would be answered with political answers to the question. And then for the niece, who's the freshman in college, who's home for the first time, what I want you to do when she's talking is I just want you to pray. I just want you to pray that you could hold your tongue. Let her explore her ideas. We sent her away to college for a reason. And if we don't let her explore the ideas, and we don't actually help her at some point filter those ideas. But I'm just saying that the first time that she's home from college is probably not the most effective time to put up the big filter. It's certainly not the time to say, I'm snatching you out of that horrible place and you're never going back and I'm not sending those people another penny. Like, please don't respond that way. Let her explore her ideas. Be confident that the way in which you raised her, be confident in that all the scripture that you poured into her life, be confident that the truth will prevail, and stay in the conversation with her. Don't do something at this Thanksgiving that's going to mean she's not just never going to talk to you again. Like, don't do that, because they have lots of options once they're in college about where they go on holidays. All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about dealing with the family member that you had to unfollow on social media during this campaign season. And then I'm going to do a quick update on, wow, what's going on in the main line. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. So one other question from over the weekend that I didn't get to, and I told you that I was headed there. So I'm gonna share with you this conversation that I had as well. Again, it's related to, hey, Thanksgiving is coming. I know who's coming to Thanksgiving dinner at this point. And there's at least one person who is coming who I had to unfollow on social media. So this woman was sharing that she has this nephew who on social media has become, over the course of the sort of the midterm election cycle, increasingly hostile, and even using language that makes her, like, personally feel bad. Like, he is putting her in a category of people, frankly, white evangelical Christians, putting her in a category that genuinely does not. I mean, it describes her. Those are words that describe her, but the things that he is saying about that category of people do not describe her. And so she finally said, I just had to just unfollow him. And she said, but, you know, I'm going to see him on Thanksgiving. And I suggested that she actually set an appointment, find a time, find a way to meet with him before Thanksgiving, because I think they both know that they're going to show up kind of loaded for bear. And that is going to be no fun for nobody. Like, that is just not going to be an enjoyable Thanksgiving day. So here was what I suggested to her. I said, you know, plan to meet with him in advance. Print out an illustrative post, like something that he posted that really hurt you, really wounded you, and make some notes on it. Like, print it out, make some notes on it. Highlight particular words with which you identify, but which are used in ways that don't reflect you. So in this case, you know, white evangelical Christian, right? So with those particular words, sitting there with your nephew, actually talk with him and ask him, you know, like, okay, so you're using, you know, this is what you're saying about white evangelical Christians. I am a white evangelical Christian. And so I want to know, Do you experience me this way? In this way that he has described white evangelical Christians in his social media posts. And he is going to say what? Well, he's immediately going to say, no, Aunt so-and-so, you know, Aunt Carmen. No, I don't mean you. I don't mean you. And then I'm going to say, here's the problem. That is me. I am a white evangelical Christian. And so when on social media you put me in this category of people, you are saying this about me. And he's going to say, well, I'm not saying it about you. I'm going to say, okay. So let's talk about these words, and let's talk about what you mean when you use these words and why you feel this way. And at one point, I'm going to have to say, you're my nephew. You're white. Like, what? So, you know, let's talk about what in here you don't identify with. What does the word evangelical mean to you? And he's probably going to define it in political terms. And we've had this conversation before on Connecting Faith. You and I, we're going to define it in theological terms. We're going to talk about the evangel. We're going to talk about the good news. We're going to talk about Jesus. We're going to talk about being gospel people, right? And then the word Christian, what, you know, nephew, so-and-so, what does that word mean to you these days? Like, you know, you grew up in our family. You grew up going to church. Tell me what this word now means to you. And then after you've let him speak his piece, you say, now let me share with you what that word means to me. Let me talk with you about the very real relationship I have with Jesus Christ. It's not a religion. It's not a set of ideas. It's not, you know, some historical, a throwback to some historical period of life. This is reality. This is contemporary reality for me. He is the Lord of my life now. He is my Savior now. He is enthroned now at the right hand of the Father. Let me tell you the things that I actually know about Jesus, the person of Jesus whom I know. Because nobody can deny your personal experience. This is the identity politics of our age, right? People love stories. They love personal stories, and they cannot deny your personal story. So start telling your personal story. Now, no matter whatever else happens out of the meeting that this aunt might have with her nephew before Thanksgiving, I can promise you this. He is going to think twice every time he posts something on social media where he uses the, you know, the description white evangelical Christian, because she's going to pop into his mind and he's going to say, I don't mean that about Aunt so-and-so. So let me figure out a different way to say this malicious thing that I'm about to say on social media. Maybe he will just not say the malicious thing at all. Okay, let me turn quickly here to something really disturbing that I was made aware of by Rod Dreher. Rod writes for the American Conservative, and he writes other places as well, but this is posted at the American Conservative. And he's writing there about a Lutheran pastor. So we're talking here about a pastor in the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, so the ELCA. And you and I probably are aware that the ELCA is a fairly liberal body. It is shrinking pretty quickly. It's in great numerical decline. But it hasn't been that long ago that we celebrated the 501st anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, celebrating the fact that a guy named Luther, Martin Luther, nailed 95, you know, statements, we call them theses, to the door at the Wittenberg Castle. And so when we talk about the Reformation, we're talking about Luther, and therefore at some level we're talking about Lutherans. And so today the ELCA represents at least one branch of Lutheranism, and there's a Lutheran pastor whose name is Nadia Boltz Weber. If you've never heard of her, now is probably the time to put a dot on your radar related to her. A few years ago, she wrote a book called Pastrix, which I'm not recommending. I'm not recommending that you read anything that she has written. I'm recommending that you be aware of her and her ideas. Well, what Rod Dreher does is he actually takes an interview that she recently gave to a gay newspaper in New Jersey called Out in New Jersey, and he also grabs a video that is posted online, a video in which she is promoting her new book, which is called Shameless, The Sexual Reformation. And there is much in this, in terms of the excerpts, both of the interview and of the video, that I cannot read on Christian radio because the language is so foul. And so let's just consider that for a moment, that this Lutheran pastor is unable to answer a question in an interview and unable to get through a promotional video for a book without cussing. Let's just pause there for a moment. And she's asked a question about the Bible. And I want to pause here for a moment because the Protestant Reformation, if it was about anything, it was about sola scriptura, right? We are going to regard the Bible as the word of God alone. We're not going to put it on a par with tradition. We're not going to say that there's an ongoing revelation. We're going to recognize the Bible alone as the word of God. And even the little motto of the Reformation, which I won't try to say because it's in Latin and I'm kind of bad at that. But it's translated this way: reformed and always being reformed according to the word of God. And what would the word of God be? Well, that would be the Bible. Well, not according to this Lutheran pastor, Nadia Boltz Weber. When asked a question about the Bible, and again, this is kind of a mocking question being asked by the interviewer from a gay newspaper in New Jersey called Out in Jersey. And they are sort of mocking that evangelical Christians in particular say, well, this, you know, the Bible's very clear on this subject. The Bible's very clear on sexuality. The Bible's very clear on marriage. The Bible's very clear. Like that would be the butt of the joke in this back and forth part of their conversation. Nadia Boltz Weber, again, ELCA ordained Lutheran pastor, says the Bible's not clear about expletive. The Bible is a library. Let's say you have a huge library in your house and you ask, what's the clear message that my library has to say about gender? Well, the poetry is going to say one thing. History is going to say another. Prose is going to say something else. Science fiction may say something beyond that. It's like saying, oh, no, the library is clear. They then move on to a conversation about sex. Let's talk about sex, the interviewer says. A big part of our coming out as a community has been a label of sexual deviancy given to us by evangelicals, which, by the way, it is not evangelicals that have given the label of sexual deviancy to people who choose to express their sexuality outside the bounds of marriage between one man and one woman, or chastity and singleness. That's actually the Bible that does that, which gets us back to that first conversation. So instead, they have a conversation about pleasure. And this conversation about pleasure, she endorses what she describes as ethically sourced porn. She says the consumption of pornography should not be shamed. There are people, I mean, that's when you just start shaking your head. And again, the language related to her forthcoming book is so vile that I have a hard time even making appropriate reference to it here on the air. Suffice it to say, she's going to have women, she's going to do an art project and have women mail her their purity rings. And she's going to melt them into a sculpture of a part of the female anatomy. It will be a fertility idol of this generation. All right, friends, we're going to make a transition from there to a much more edifying conversation with Adrian Pye about his new book, The Minority Experience. If you have ever wanted to know how to get into the conversation about diversity today, we're going to help. This is Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Joining me now, Adrian Pay. He is the author of The Minority Experience. He's an organizational development consultant and leadership trainer. He speaks and writes on cross-cultural dynamics and ethnicity. He has served as the Associate National Director of Leadership Development of the EPIC Movement, the Asian American Ministry of CRU. Adrian, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thanks so much. Really great to be on the show. Appreciate it.
So we just had Kathy Kang on Monday, and you know, we didn't have you on because she endorsed your book, but we like her a lot. And we like
yeah,
the things that
friend.
She's talking about. Yeah. So I want to continue to till the soil with our audience, and so it would help me if you just started by telling us about yourself. Like, what gives you the credibility to write a book about the minority experience?
Well, So a little bit of background is I'm Chinese American. I was born in the United States. And actually, I've never been to China, interestingly. So I have kind of the Chinese cultural background. And then my parents, my father was actually born in Japan. And was actually raised in Vietnam. So there's actually a lot of Asian influence. I have the Vietnamese as well as the Chinese. So I kind of grew up with a lot of Asian experiences. So part of my own experiences as a cultural background, as well as moving around the world through different continents over the past of my life. And then, you know, really, you know, my work is the area of organizational development and kind of talking, working with teams to deal with diversity and improving their organization. So that's my current job right now. I actually work for Honda, which is a kind of Japanese American company. And I also work part-time for Campus Crusade for Christ. A decade, I had leadership development and really helping people to talk about cross-cultural issues. So that's kind of been my passion.
Hey, Adrian, I want people to really hear what you're saying, and our connection with you is not great. So I'm going to actually have the production team reconnect with you. And friends, while we're reconnecting with Adrian, I'm just gonna read you the introduction here to the Minority Experience, so that you get a sense of what he's talking about. He says, this is not an easy book to write. Race is one of the most polarizing topics in the world today. While some people love to read every blog and news item related to race, others don't think we should talk about it at all. Some people are eager to become more culturally intelligent, while others bemoan how they need to be so PC about everything. So he actually is writing this book called The Minority Experience, Navigating Emotional and Organizational Realities, as an effort to equip all of us to have conversations, to not only to understand ourselves better and where we are in terms of our own social location, but then to actually lead our organizations. And, you know, there's lots of organizational leaders out there. When you think about all of the organizations that you are engaged in, I want you to be engaging in them as a leader, as a person of influence. And so there are ways in which those of us who come out of a majority experience can actually leverage our platforms, our access, the systems that we know how to engage. So we can actually leverage those for folks who come from a minority experience. And how we might do that is one of the things that Adrian explores in this book. So, Adrian, hey, welcome back to Connecting Faith. Hopefully we got a better connection.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, that's terrific. Okay, so let's just jump back in. So there's lots of organizations, including churches, that are, you know, they recognize the need to focus more attention on the experience of minorities, particularly those in their midst. Let's just tell us from your experience, like, how do those conversations then get started? Instead of just like you and I talking over here on the side about the fact that we have got to talk about this in our organization, how does the conversation actually get started, you know, sort of on a wider level?
I mean, I think that when it comes to conversations about race, diversity, it really comes down to what's the motivation for it. You know, because I think that very often we maybe feel a sense of obligation, like we should engage it, or it's our duty, or it's a charity kind of thing to do. But I think that it really comes down to what is the importance of it. And I think for those who are Christian, and I am a Christian, there is the aspect of the idea of really reflecting the image of God, you know, how he created the body to be many parts and not just one. And, you know, first, I think of 1 Corinthians 12 and thinking about, you know, the hand is not the foot. And but there, you know, that passage talks about how there's some parts of the body that are kind of historically treated as being less honorable or valuable, but they're actually indispensable. So I think, you know, a lot of it comes down to really understanding that, you know, God is not just one culture reflects God, and there's a lot that we can learn from that. But there's also other things for organizations, like in terms of just thinking about how can an organization actually distinguish itself and become competitive. I think that's one thing that I've learned being in the corporate world is that, you know, organizations will truly get behind if they don't at least reflect the demographics of this country. And so a lot of organizations are, if their demographics don't reflect the country, they're already behind in some ways in terms of like what will help draw people to their organization and bring innovative ideas and kind of help them get ahead.
And I think part of that is, like, right, when I walk into a room, when I look online at what an event is going to be about or who's engaged, I'm looking for what? I'm looking for people who look like me. I mean, I think that's sort of natural. And so what I hear you saying is, as the culture becomes more diverse, if our organizations, including our churches, but certainly the other Christian ministries as well, if we're not reflecting the diversity of the nation of which we are a part and also the nation that we're trying to reach for Christ, our starting point is bad. Like, right? We don't look the part. And I'm with you. We don't want to diversify our leadership or diversify who we're taking pictures of because we want people to be sure that they see a diversity. It's actually at a really heart level. Like, we have to come to the place where we understand we stand on equal footing with people of every tribe and nation at creation. And we do so as well at the cross and in the kingdom. And so what we're talking about reflecting is a kingdom reality. And I love the emphasis that you place on that. There's a motivation conversation to be had here. Let's talk about language, because one of the things that you do in the book is that you give us some language, you give us some categories for the kinds of emotional and psychological realities that of the minority experience. Can you give folks an example of that?
Sure. So I guess the easiest way to describe it is that I classify the minority experience in the book according to three categories, and their pain, power, and the past. And that really is just a way to help us understand a little more than skin deep kind of what it means to be a minority, because sometimes we just look at the skin level, or the skin color of somebody, or we look at just numbers in terms of like, okay, I was the only person of that ethnicity in the room, so I'm a minority. But what I talk about is really pain. Meaning that when we look at pain, that means we have to go deeper than head knowledge and understand why minorities often feel things like invisible, weary, a sense of injustice in the organizations they're in. And so pain is really going deeper than the head knowledge. And then power, meaning that we need to focus on that there's a gap between majority and minority groups and not everyone's on equal ground. So a classic example I give is the fact that, you know, women numerically have been 50% of the population, but, you know, how long did it take for them to get the right to vote? So it's not just about numbers. It's about, you know, societal power and what people feel like, the voice that people feel like they can have in society. And then the past, meaning that history often shapes us and our reactions to the things that are going on around us more than we realize. Even something as simple as the fact that why is it that the language I'm speaking right now is called English? Right, as opposed to I speak American or United States or whatever, right? So there's this idea that, you know, it's because England, you know, many, many years ago colonized so many countries throughout the world. So that's why that language is so prevalently spoken throughout the world. And so, you know, even in something as simple as the name of the language that I'm speaking right now, the past, something that happened many, many years ago really impacts our realities today. So in the book, I really kind of classify things according to these three categories and say if we can really understand those three things, we'll be on our way to understanding the minority experience in a better way.
So I like the word Christian there as well, because obviously that locates my identity with something that occurred at a point in time in a place very remote, in the distant past. And yet I bring that forward, right? I mean, we talk as Christians as if the cross happened yesterday, in many ways. So I think that for Christians, if we can help them see that there are words, the word English is a great one, but that there are words that we have brought forward with us and that are contemporary realities that connect us with all of these things, pain, power, and the past, I do think that there are conversational points at which this is going to make sense to Christians who come from a majority experience and help them to begin bridging those conversational gaps with folks from a minority experience. Again, friends, I'm talking with Adrian Pay. We're talking about his new book, The Minority Experience, Navigating Emotional and Organizational Realities. Let's talk about the thing that, frankly, a lot of people don't want to talk about. I mean, when I I'll just admit that when I am trying to have to, when I'm trying to till the soil of this particular conversation, and I'm trying to do so with folks who come out of a majority experience, when I move into conversations that you describe in the book as like broader forces of organizations in history, like those things that have like shaped the culture, nobody wants to have those conversations because it seems to be very guilt producing. Can you just talk with us about maybe the importance of having the conversations about broader culture shaping realities? We might call them systems. We might call them, I'll just call them systems for lack of a better word.
Yeah, one thing that I really wanted to do in this book is really write the book in a way that wasn't shaming to people who are of the majority culture, because I believe that, you know, they're my brothers and sisters, you know, and I believe that the only way that we can really make progress is for minorities and majority culture to work together. Really, you can't do it with just one side because there's a lot of a very important role that majority culture has to play in terms of the power, the advocacy that they do have. And so I wrote it in a way that, and that's a feedback that I've been getting from a lot of majority culture readers, is that when they read it, they feel like it's educational, but it's not shaming. And they feel like they can be part of it and that it gives them eyes to see things that they didn't understand about minorities and about themselves. And I think that the broader conversation is so important. And I think one thing that I am encouraging people is that often it feels personal. But really, very often, it's not as personal as we may feel it is, in the sense that sometimes the forces that have shaped us go back a long ways in history. And so that's why I talk about history a lot, where very often, I give an example from a TV show called Survivor. I don't know if any of our listeners watch that, but there's a scene where there's an African-American man who is called, I think it's Crazy, by a white contestant. And he takes it in terms of race. And then the white contestant kind of says, I didn't mean that at all. And he probably didn't mean it at all. But the African-American contestant explains how, because of the connotations of that word from many, many years ago, like, he can't not associate that with his people and what they went through. And so in that situation, it's not like it was about intention or whatever it was. It was just that historically the connotations of these words have such meaning for people, and it's not necessarily personal to what that person was doing or not doing or intending or not. So I think that in the book I try to diffuse that a little bit and just say that even if we have good intentions, sometimes there's historical forces that impact us, and to understand that helps us understand the people that we're talking to better. And I also talk about in a sense of leadership is that, you know, sometimes when people react in a certain way that confuses us, you know, really, you know, as leaders, we want to understand our people, you know, that we're working with. And even if it doesn't feel fair or doesn't feel right, if we can understand why they're reacting the way they are, that's just good leadership. And so that's part of what I talk about in the book as well.
So I'm curious, Adrian, you know, maybe less of a book question and more sort of a cultural assessment question. Is there something or are there some things that it like surprises you that it's taking us so long to learn?
Well, that's a really interesting question. In the work for this book, I really did a lot of historical research. And so, you know, it started really with my own journey, you know, in terms of like I tell my own story in the book of like kind of this pain power in the past and my experiences in organizations and in this country. But then, you know, I really looked beyond that to look at history and to see kind of the history of race relations throughout the years. And also the Bible. I looked at the Bible and said, oh, wow, you know, a lot of these themes I see actually in the lives of people like Daniel and, you know, Ruth and even Jesus. And I was thinking, wow, these are really not new things. And so actually in some ways, I learned that it kind of didn't surprise me in some ways. I learned that a lot of the things that we've been dealing with in terms of some of the cross-cultural tension and issues we've been trying to deal with, it has been going on for many, many years. And I think it can make us feel a little bit like, is there any hope? Because it like will just keep on happening. But I do believe that there's progress that's being made. And one reason I centered this book on faith was because I really believe that, you know, I said pain, power in the past, but really, you know, I really focus on the second half of the book on talking about how when we bring our experiences to God and to other people, pain can really become compassion. power can really become advocacy, and then the past can really lead us to some wisdom. Because when we understand what happened in the past, we can have more insight into the future and what we can do. So I believe that, I mean, in some ways it does feel like we have a lot to learn still, but when we look to the past, we actually can learn quite a bit too.
Hey friends, the book is The Minority Experience, Navigating Emotional and Organizational Realities. The author is Adrian Pei. You're going to spell that P-E-I when you are searching for him online. Adrian, thank you so much for this book. Thank you for inviting us into a conversation that we're all very interested in having but don't know how to start. And thank you for giving us what I would say is the conversational framework upon which we can really build. So thank you for being with us today on Connecting Faith.
I really appreciate you having me. Thanks for the conversation.
Hey, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, we'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. But I know we're gonna make it. I know we're gonna get there soon. And I know sometimes. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. All right, so here's today's connecting point. This was sort of how the conversation went. How do you do it? I said, do what? How do you do it? How do you not respond to people in the way that they have started a conversation with you? I said, what? And they said, well, how do you not get your feelings hurt? And I thought to myself, well, I probably don't focus on that a lot. I'm focusing on hearing what that other person is trying to say, even if they're trying to say it in a way that is in a tone and in words that are really hard to hear. But I really am interested in what is this person saying, not how am I feeling about what this person is saying. I'm trying to understand people. And so then they said, well, how is it that you can treat people in the way that you want to be treated instead of in the way that they're treating you? And I basically like acknowledge that that is something just learned by wisdom over time. And I'm not saying that every older person that I know is good at this. I'm saying that as I have gotten older, I have gotten better at this. And so that might be an encouragement to you today. So I just wanted to share this, and I shared it online at reconnectwithcarmen.com if you want to go read the whole thing. But about 20 years ago now, in fact, I think it was 20 years. It may be more than 20 years ago as I'm like doing the math. I was walking down the large hall of a convention center. I could tell you what city it's in, but then it would specifically date it. And probably everybody's going to know which organization I'm talking about. And I don't really want to be that specific. So I was walking down the large hall of a convention center that there was a national church meeting going on. And there was one person yelling at the top of their lungs. And it was a person behind me some distance. So initially, I did not know that he was yelling at me. But everybody could hear him. And so, you know, like everybody turned. And he's just yelling, you, you. And I turned to see him. And he wasn't really running because he had like a satchel and an arm full of papers that were, you know, not in a very neat stack. And he's nearly running in my direction. And he's pointing what I will describe as a very accusatory finger. I became very familiar with that finger over the next few minutes. So I can describe it as a very accusatory finger. I didn't run. I mean, I might run today, like, right? Like my sense of my own personal safety has probably changed over time. But I can tell you that I actually felt no sense of physical fear. None. I mean, I could see him coming to me. I could see that his eyes were locked on me. I then knew that the you that he was kind of growling was directed at me. I just simply lifted up a breath prayer as he approached. You know, God, whatever he has to say, let me really hear him. Like, I don't know what else to pray at that point. You know, whatever he needs to say, like, let me actually hear him. Through his demeanor, through his tone, even at some level through the words that he's going to choose to use. So I was, suffice it to say, a very unpopular person at this particular gathering because I was holding to what I would now describe as historically Christian positions on issues that were in direct contradiction to the felt needs and desired outcomes of those who were at that point sort of on a war path to change the sexual standards of that particular denomination. So there were theological and policy positions that left me the least popular girl in the room at the time, because I was, again, trying to uphold these historically Christian positions. And it made my my advocacy look to people for whom all of these issues were personal. It made my advocacy like personal animus in their minds. Like they viewed me as personally opposing them. Instead of this being a conversation about ideas, for them it was literally all personal. Now, those who knew me, and those certainly who know me now, know that that is not true. Like I can talk about theological and policy positions and feel no animus whatsoever to others who hold positions that differ from my own. But the man approaching me, he was convinced that I was quite literally the enemy, the physical bodily manifestation of the enemy. And as he drew near, his right hand sort of forming the shape of a gun, kind of pointed down a little bit. Like it's radio, so you can't see what I'm doing. But his entire body is like aggressively surging with adrenaline. And he's just repeating again and again and again, "It's all your fault. It's all your fault." I mean, he is consumed with this idea. It's all your fault. And the rest of his speech was laden with words that are not worthy of repeating here on the air. And so I just let him vent for a while. And when I perceived that he was basically done, I just asked in reply, like, all of what? Like, it's all my fault. That covers, you know, like a really wide swath. All of what? What exactly is my fault? Now, he's fuming. So you have to give him a minute to search for his words. And once he found some words, he said something like this. Like, those people... And there he's referring to the people with whom I had been communicating in terms of advocacy across the country. Those people don't need to know what you've told them. They only needed to hear my story. They only needed to hear the stories of other people like me. You're confusing them, and it's all your fault. I'll say it this way. This is not the way that he said it, but, you know, what I came to do is not working out, and that's all your fault. And he continued down this accusatory path, and closing my eyes right now, like I can still see his very like finger kind of crooked, less than maybe an inch from my nose. And he's like just pointing it in this very accusatory way. I can actually still smell his sweat. I can see his very dilated pupils. This was like rage manifested in a person. Arguing with him would have proven utterly fruitless. And although I wanted to, like, at some points, like, burst out laughing at the absurdity of his charge that everything, all of it, was literally my fault, I determined instead to simply to stand there silently, my shoulders, like, slack, my facial muscles relaxed, looking him in the eye without judgment, praying breath prayers that God would let me hear him. Now, I recognize that was not me. That was clearly the Spirit of God, because that's not how Carmen would respond, but it is how Jesus would respond. He made some, you know, continued demands and accusatory statements, and I just stood there. I eventually decided there's really nothing that I could say that seemed worth saying. And afterwards, as I've reflected on that, I've just begun to recognize that sometimes all we can do is simply stand. And in my experience, you and I carry ourselves into the conversations of the day, sometimes in a very adversarial environment. But how we carry ourselves into those conversations matters, because we carry the name of Christ. And then how we speak in words and body language and posture and tone, those matter, because we speak the truth of Christ. And so that's what I want you to do today. I want you to go out there into the world, and regardless of how others approach you and with what accusations, just be Christ person, be evangelical, be a gospel person today in the world, because they really need it. Hey, friends, that's all the time we've got here today on Connecting Faith. You can connect with me online at reconnectwithcarmen.com. You can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.